You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. Our next guest is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, a documentary filmmaker, a nonprofit CEO, and someone who at any moment could be deported from the country he grew up in. When he was 12, Jose Antonio Vargas moved from the Philippines to Mountain View. When he was 16, he found out the papers he was using here were false. When he was 27, he shared a Pulitzer for his work at the Washington Post, and when he was 30, he outed himself, against the advice of multiple lawyers, as an undocumented person in a piece for the New York Times Magazine. That put him squarely in the center of a new social movement of young people exposing themselves to deportation for the sake of making their stories public. He's just out with a new book on his life so far. It's entitled Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Jose Antonio Vargas, thank you so much for coming in.
I like the so far part. Because, you know, it's not. It's...
Hopefully you have many decades to go.
When I was writing it, It's tough to think of your life in like stages because we don't live our lives in stages. It's just one life, right? But in writing it, I had to really grapple with what, you know, even those innocent years from 12 years old to 16 year old in which I didn't know that I was here illegally and America was just this one big question mark. You know, when I look back at it, I was like, man, those were the great years. Like, you know, those. And then from, you know, the time at the Washington Post, living in Washington, D.C., working for the Washington Post was probably the toughest, like, 5 years of my life just because I, you know, this was post 9/11. It was Bush as president. It was the Iraq War. And you can't, you know, you can't swing a backpack in D.C. without hitting someone who, like, worked in security. And it was just... paranoia. I didn't realize that too until I was really grappling with the book and how much my life was run by paranoia. Mm. And that's why, as you know, like, you know, when you read the book, like it's structured. I structured it in three parts: lying, passing, and hiding, because those are the three kind of states of being that I have found myself in the past, you know, 25 years of being here illegally.
Yeah. Why don't we start with the backstory? When you're in the Philippines with your mother, you're kind of already part of the U.S. economy because you're living off remittances from your grandparents who are here and working with documents.
Yes.
What was America to you as a kid in the Philippines?
Well, America was Coke. It was Pepsi. America was M&M's. America was like the Balik Bayan box, which is like the repatriate box that we got every 2 months that would have Spam t-shirts. And, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't know that it was made in the USA. Like, you know, Tagalog is like Spanish. You break the syllables down. I thought it was Made in USA. Made in USA. So I thought that was like, I don't know. I thought it was just like something from America. And so America was the stuff that we got. It was Whitney Houston. It was Baywatch. It was Oprah interviewing Michael Jackson. And I didn't really know anything about not just America, but the world, right? Like, I think I wrote in the book that the closest I got to seeing the world was the Miss Universe pageant. My mother loved the Miss Universe pageant, and we always saw it live every year. And that's how I got to know that there's South America, Central America, and North America, right? And that there's this thing called Africa, right? And like, and that I was part of Southeast Asia, okay? You know, like that. So, and it, for me, part of the writing of the book was kind of complicating this idea of people think that we come here because of the American dream and the Statue of Liberty and what Emma Lazarus wrote in that poem, when the reality is we didn't know any of that. Right? Like, our vision of America was because our family is here. Like, you know, it was always inevitable that family members were coming to America. And then in the book, as you know, like, I ended up kind of tracing that, right? Like, why are there so many Filipinos in the United States? Yeah. So it was important for me to kind of insist on the complexity of that beyond this understanding that we come here for a better life.
Yeah. Well, why don't we do that complexity then? How did the portions of your family that were here with documents wind up in the United States?
Yeah. So they were here. My grandfather was the first one to come because of his sister. So who was able to come here legally because she married a U.S. citizen who fought in the army. And what had happened was right after that was the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act, which is the reason why the country looks the way that it looks. So that stopped the racial quotas from the 1920s and allowed not only people with college degrees to come, but they have this entire category called family unification. So my grandmother, who lives in Santa Clara, Florida, this asked my grandfather, Teofilo, if he wanted to come to America, and the answer was yes. So he was able to come in 1983 when I was 2 years old. And then his wife, my grandmother, followed like 6 months later. And then that's how they got here. And which is why to me right now, I mean, I can't say this without talking about the political backdrop that we have, which is that one of the under-realized realities happening in the country right now is the Trump administration and Trump himself has done a very good job blurring the lines between legal and illegal immigration, mm-hmm. right? I don't know if you've noticed, every time they've said, we'll make DACA permanent, we'll fix the DREAM Act, whatever, they've said, but that would come with cutting legal immigration by half, right? So it's not just we're against, quote unquote, illegal people. We just don't want any more immigrants here. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At least that's the Stephen Miller wing of
the Trump
administration.
That's the Stephen Miller wing. And I think it's been the effective wing of the Trump administration. I mean, I'm still getting – I think it's so important for us to realize what – not only the damage, but how this has been a manifestation, right? Like when I was growing up here in the Bay Area – and watching Fox News and kind of hearing what Fox News was already doing in making immigrants kind of the other and the foreigner, and then how groups like Center for Immigration Studies or Numbers USA or FAIR, kind of these anti-immigrant groups that used to be the fringe that are now mainstream and whose actual employees who used to work for them are now at the White House. Right. So there's been a complete kind of like this very structured, very organized anti-immigrant, you know, wing that has taken hold of the country, right? And so this is why it's been fascinating as a journalist who happens to be undocumented living in this moment, because people are like, Trump, Trump, Trump. And I'm like, wait a second. No. This has been happening since the Clinton era, mm-hmm. right? Trump is only the manifestation of everything nonsensical that we have thought of policy-wise about immigration.
So the most striking thing that comes through in your narrative when you're trying to contextualize all this is all the ties other than immigration that already exist. Mm. 250,000 Filipinos serve in the U.S. Armed Forces during World War II.
Yes.
Without getting citizenship.
Without getting citizenship.
Even though they were promised it. Philippines, obviously, huge military staging base mm-hmm. for the United States, which is how your grandmother
strategic.
Winds up yep. falling in love with a Marine.
Yes.
And becoming the first link in the chain of family reunification.
The first of 32.
And you and your mother are living off remittances from your grandparents in the Philippines until she can get you smuggled into the United States to join them.
Because there was no way to do it legally, mm-hmm. right? I mean, after I found that, I was like, couldn't you just do this the right way? But I come from a family that didn't talk to lawyers, right? The plan was smuggle me here, have me marry a woman who's a U.S. citizen while working under the table at the flea market as a janitor on Berryessa Road, and then that was it. I mean, that was the plan. And I think a lot of this too has to do with this mentality that not all, but some Filipinos have about their place in America, right? I mean, that's another theme that I really wanted to kind of capture in this very compact book, which is that, you know, there are many Filipino relatives of mine who are my aunts and my uncles and even my cousins who are here legally, who are green card holders, some of whom have naturalized, but have decided that America is just, it's something we eat, it's something we consume, it's something we buy, it's not something we participate in. Like, we're just here to work, right? And that's why I was also very intentional in using the word citizen on the cover, right, the title of the book, Undocumented Citizen. Like, what does it mean to be a citizen of this country? And what does it mean to participate in this country? I think one of the ironies of the moment we're living in now is, you know, you hear so much about dreamers and young undocumented people. And I think what happens, what we have to understand is, for the most part, those undocumented activists are actually exhibit the most citizenship in their family, because they live with immigrant relatives who can't participate or don't want to participate or feel like America doesn't want them here anyway. So why even fight? Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So that kind of complexity in our family life. And that's why when I wrote this book, I really wanted to dig deeper into the psychology of it. Because look, there's a lot of really great memoirs out there about immigration. There's also a lot of kind of anthropological, you know, demographic studies about what immigrants are doing to America. But when I read all those books, what I thought was lacking was getting into the emotional state of what it means to currently be undocumented.
Well, tell me how you found out you were undocumented.
Oh, I found out when I went to the DMV, because my friend Arvin Murthy, who was my classmate in high school, I think was getting tired of driving me around and very politely said it might be time to get a driver's permit. So I did. I went to the DMV in my bike, and I was listening to Alanis Morissette and Boyz II Men on my Walkman. And, you know, I didn't really think much about it. I brought my Mountain View High School ID. And then I brought this thing called a green card, because, you know, my grandfather said it was a piece of document that said that I was here. And I didn't ask for anybody's permission, because why? I mean, just thought, just go. So I went. And then when I got called into the booth at the DMV right across the Target in Mountain View, the woman, you know, she looked at my Mountain View High School ID. She didn't care about that. And then she looked at the green card. She flipped it maybe three times, no more than 10 seconds. And she like lowers herself in the booth and she said, "This is fake. Don't come back here again." Initially, the moment she said fake, in my head, all I could think of was, I'm not Mexican.
Because undocumented immigrants scanned as Mexican.
Because that's what the radio said, uh-huh. That's what the television said, that's what the Mercury News, that's what the San Francisco Chronicle, that's what the cover of Time Magazine, you know, everything I consumed media-wise, this is why stories we tell are so important, right? Everything I was consuming about America media-wise said that whenever anybody said anything about illegal or fake people or immigration, it was about Mexicans, it wasn't about us. And I was going to tell her, you know, my name is Jose, but I'm actually Filipino, Spanish colonialism. I used to assume she was wrong. And so I rode my bike home. My grandfather was a security guard who worked the graveyard shift, so he was home during the day. And I confronted him, and he basically said two things. What are you doing showing that to people, the ID, the green card? The second thing, you're not supposed to be here. So that's how I found out. And then I had just, I think, 2 weeks before, had seen Goodfellas, the movie by Scorsese, and I was thinking to myself, is my family in the mob or something? Like, what is this? Like, when he started explaining kind of what the plan was, and that the uncle that brought me here was a smuggler that he paid $4,500 to, I was just aghast. You know, back then, certainly, I didn't have the word aghast in my vocabulary, but I was just so confused and so lost, and of course wondering the whole time, why didn't anybody tell me this? Was I supposed to just kind of like go along into this plan? Like, why did I not have a say? Like, what? Why did my mom think that this was okay? So that's when, for me, I think in many ways, that's when my journalism career probably started, because I'm asking these like hard questions that I didn't have any answers to. And also it was a way of declaring my own kind of independence, right? Like the moment he said, "You're going to marry a woman," I think about a day or so later, I said, "You know, I'm gay. And I'm not doing that." So basically, we're not going to correct your lie with another lie, right? Like, you lied, and so now you want me to lie, and you want me to live a lie. No, we're not going to do that. The irony, of course, is that I've had to lie. Not about being gay, but about being here illegally.
Yeah. I mean, so that's how you felt about, you know, your mother and your grandparents and what they did to get you into the country. But, I mean, it strikes me that the opening chapters of the book are basically describing are you describing a very immigrant experience, which is playing catch up, right? To try to fit into American society and sort out your place in it, and develop cultural fluency. Did that revelation make you question whether you had a place here? Was there anything beyond the anger at your relatives?
Let's talk about this phrase, cultural fluency, because mm-hmm. I think it's so important, right? Some people would call it, quote unquote, integration or assimilation. I didn't know any of that. All I knew was I had a really thick Filipino accent that sounded like that, mm-hmm. and that I couldn't be this, quote unquote, illegal person with a thick Filipino accent. So the first thing I did was get rid of the accent. And how did I do that? I mean, watch as much PBS, Bill Moyers. I just recently met Bill Moyers and I...
You were like, I need a Midwestern accent.
I showed him my iPhone in which I have a playlist of all of his interviews that I listen to when I'm at airports. Like his interview with Toni Morrison was just, I think once a week I listen to it. And then I didn't think that was enough. And so I needed to sound like Dr. Dre. So I figured sound white and sound black. No one is going to question that you, where you're from. So cultural fluency for me was not only a way of figuring out where I fit, because I didn't even think about that. I just thought of how do I pass? Like, how do I like not be what people think I'm supposed to be? Right? Especially again, how the media, you know, in all mediums portray us is so different from the reality of who we are, you know, collectively and individually. So that was my way of kind of dealing with that. And in many ways, I was really good at it. I passed for 14 years, you know, from 16 to 30. No one ever questioned it. You know, I mean, I remember when I was in D.C. at the Washington Post, you know, when I would be assigned, one year I got assigned to cover the White House state dinner with the Japanese prime minister. And, you know, I'd never been to the White House, and I guess the White House needs your Social Security number. The moment I gave the Social Security number, which is invalid, to the secretary, I knew that I was going to get found out. I'm like sitting at my desk, and Dana Milbank, who I used to work with, was wondering why I wasn't dressed up. Because, you know, I'm from the Bay Area. I dress like this all the time, right? But we're going to go to the White House, and he's like, Jose, you need a tie. And he's like pressuring me that I need to like dress up to get to the White House briefing room and, you know, go to the White House. And that was, I was just waiting for someone to call from the White House to tell the Washington Post that the Social Security number is invalid and you have someone who's here illegally working in your newsroom. That paranoia that just, you know, that was my life in D.C. for 5 years. And after the election of Barack Obama, I had to get out. And that was the other thing. Like, what's constant about the book, and I'm talking about myself like I'm not myself, but when I was writing it, what was very clear was that I'd been running for so long. Mm-hmm. Even the way the book is written, I wanted to capture that kind of rhythm of like this person, me, who has had to kind of run and hide for like, you know, 14 years, not realizing what the cost of that is.
So how did it affect your work having that hanging over you? I mean, that's an immense source of stress.
Well, actually, that's an interesting question. How it impacted it is I just buried myself in the work. Uh-huh. You know, like the only thing that mattered was the work. Nothing else mattered.
If you just bounce from deadline to deadline, you don't have to think about the bigger stuff.
That is actually the beauty of journalism. For me, you bounce from, I can't tell you the years, I can tell you what I was working on. Like 2006 was all about AIDS and video games. All I wrote of was the culture of video games and the HIV/AIDS epidemic in Washington, D.C. That was 2006. 2007, I was traveling across the country covering the presidential campaign, right? So it was, and the thing about journalism was, the story was there. I wrote it. My byline is in it. But I'm also am not there because I'm supposed to write not about myself but about other people. So it was kind of this perfect balance of contributing and participating but not having to kind of, you know, divulge who I am as a person, right? I always was amazed whenever I would talk to columnists whose job it is to kind of bring themselves into what they're writing about. And I always ask myself, like, how do they go? How do they earn that? Like, how does that work? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, why does David Broder get a column? I actually asked him that question once. He's like, I don't know, Jose. I think just think I'm old and, you know, they just figured, give me a column. He was a wonderful man. David Roeder was a wonderful, wonderful man.
You know, it strikes me that journalism is not a natural career for someone who is undocumented and has every incentive to keep their head down. It would not occur to most people to choose a job where you have to put your name on bylines in national publications and perhaps get your social security number submitted for a security clearance at the White House.
But the thing, though, is, and again, you have to remember, I was 16 years old. There was no Google. There was nobody to talk to. The moment I figured out that when you write a news story, your name would be on the newspaper, that was it for me. Like, that was it. Like, I thought, if I am not here because the green card is fake and no document says that I'm here, what if my name is on the paper? That is literally the only reason why I became a journalist. There were no writers in my family. There was, I think, the only book we had was like an incomplete encyclopedia that my grandfather got in a garage sale just because it looked good on the shelf. Like, we didn't read. We were not a reading family. So that was the only reason why I became a journalist. And I figured while I was in it, once I got into it, there was no going back, right? Like, I was so myopic. You know, I was the kind of person that I remember my junior year in college, I applied for like 8 summer internships and I got all 8 of them. And I was, okay, I'm going to work at the Washington Post in the summer and then I'm going to the Miami Herald in the fall. Like, I was going to school at San Francisco State. That didn't really matter to me. I was like, the byline was the only thing that mattered, right? Which, again, sounds crazy now, but you have to understand, like, I was living with trauma without even realizing that it was trauma. And I had to hold on to something, and it was all I could hold on to.
So what got you to the point where you wanted to out yourself?
ID. So the only reason why I was able to have a career was because of a driver's license, right? So when the Washington Post offered me an internship in 2003, they were like, hey, we need to see a driver's license. Up to that point, I just lied and said, oh, I have one, even though I didn't. Right. Like, when I interned at the Philadelphia Daily News, I just actually put this in the book. I hitchhiked, like, you know, to like cover some stories. But the Washington Post was very insistent. No, we need to see an ID. So at that time, I remember I put this in the book. I spent, you know, most of the day at the Mountain View Public Library printing out the requirements for each one of the 50 states. Thankfully, we have this thing called federalism. And each state had a different requirement how to get a driver's license. And found out that Oregon and Tennessee had the most lenient requirements. And you look at the map and you're like, okay, Tennessee is all the way over there. And Oregon is just like one state away after Washington State. So I picked Oregon and I needed help. I needed to find somebody who lived in Oregon. I didn't know anybody. And I needed to establish residency. Thankfully, a friend's husband's dad lived in Portland. A hippie dude, and he was down to help me out and have me use his address in Portland, Oregon. And then I had my high school principal, my high school superintendent, my superintendent's secretary, and a couple of friends mail me letters to this address. And so those were the 5 pieces of like mail that I brought to the Portland driver's license office. Got the license. The license was valid for 8 years, 2003 to 2011. And it expired on my 30th birthday, February 3rd, 2011. So I thought I had 8 years to, quote unquote, earn this citizenship thing, right? That's something that I completely internalize. Whenever anybody talks about passing any sort of reform, they said, you know, earn citizenship for all these people who are here illegally. So I thought, hey, I can go earn that. I can do everything I can to be, quote unquote, successful. Did that. Year passed by. 2011 is coming. I had just profiled Mark Zuckerberg for The New Yorker in 2010. And it was either I leave, which I thought about for a while, because, you know, I haven't seen my mom since I was 12.
Leave as in leave the country.
As in leave the country. This is before Mitt Romney came up with the whole self-deportation thing.
Right.
Leave.
But this was also the only solution immigration lawyers spelled out to you in detail.
The only solution.
Leave, wait 10 years.
Wait
and apply
10 years,
to come
thanks
back.
To Bill Clinton and what Bill Clinton passed into law in the mid 90s, right? That was the only solution. So leave or stay. And then, as any reporter would do, I think, I reported it. So I spoke to at least, 20 immigration lawyers, mostly in the Bay Area. And the more the lawyers told me how much trouble I was in, I remember a woman at Stanford University, an immigration lawyer, said to me, "You weren't supposed to make it that far." The moment she said that, I think something clicked in my head that I had to go do this. I had to actually blow the whistle on myself and do something that I had avoided in, the years that I was doing journalism, which is use I, me, and my, right? I had to write it, and I had to just figure out how do I, and, from the very beginning, my goal was how do I complicate this, right? Mind you, when I did this 7 years ago, and at the same time, knowing that mine is only one story, so I started an organization called Define American, which is now kind of, we are a platform for storytelling, and we collect stories and we use those stories to help screenwriters, producers, directors better integrate immigrant storylines into television shows and movies. And we help the news media, my colleagues in journalism, better understand what this issue is.
There was a turning point in American politics. Deportations were at an all-time high under the Obama administration.
3 million in total.
But it had not really become a national conversation topic until this wave of young undocumented people started coming forward as part of the Undocumented and Unafraid movement and risking deportation, kind of forcing the question by telling their stories, by participating in civil disobedience. I'm curious how, in your mind, that moment of accelerated deportations but lack of attention compares to what we're going through now, where the Trump administration is posturing on immigration issues, has put the issue front and center. But by the numbers, not deporting more people than the Obama administration was at a tight.
I think that's a really important thing to remember. But also, you're dealing with ICE, which is the most rogue enforcement agency in this country that has been, it's like this octopus that has just been with all of the possible ways to kind of get itself into our communities, into different states and all of that. So I think you can't really separate the Trump administration from how deep ICE has gotten into disrupting communities. They may not be deporting us, but they're arresting us and detaining us. And what the New York Times story recently was 3,800 kids locked up in a tent in South Texas. Now, mind you, I remember because, in the book I wrote about what it was like to be detained in South Texas in 2014 when Obama was president. And also when CBS News, I'll never forget this because I'm a big 60 Minutes fan. CBS News, illegal immigrant children crossing the border. That was the narrative.
This was the wave of children coming from Central America,
unaccompanied minors at the border back in 2014 when it wasn't a humanitarian crisis, when it wasn't treated of as this urgent matter and that families belong to, that's the hashtag now, families belong together. Back in 2014, it was like, send them back, everyone, from the president, President Obama, to Hillary Clinton, to Joe Biden, all said, send them back, right? So something had shifted, and I think Trump, I don't believe in any silver lining in the Trump administration. I just think of opportunities. And I think an opportunity here is to really ask ourselves harder questions as to why people are coming, right? The why and the how, right? And also really coming to grips with what systems have we created? I've been on a book tour, because of this book. The first event, I think the first interview I did was the Today Show. When the book came out on September 18th. And what has been consistent throughout this entire process so far is that the one thing journalists say to me as they're interviewing me about the book is, I just can't believe you can't get legal.
Because they're people who've had the system working out for them their whole lives.
That, not only that, but when journalists themselves who are tasked to inform the public doesn't know that there is no process for millions of people to legalize themselves, that it's not as easy as turning on a switch and oops, the light's on. It doesn't work like that. Isn't that incredible? We talk about this issue so much. A simpleton got elected president because he made immigration central to his campaign. And yet, most people don't understand the basic truths about what the issue is. and process, right? I find that astounding. You know, there's a book I read when I was, I think 2008, when I was a political reporter at The Post. I read a book called The Race Beat. It won the Pulitzer, I think, for history. And it's all about what happened when white journalists from the North went to the South and called it what it was. Right, that was a turning point in how the civil rights movement was covered. All of a sudden, objectivity, all of that. It's like, this is wrong. This is a human rights issue. We are not quite there yet when it comes to this issue. I think journalists have yet to really connect the dots and understand that immigration is not just about politics and policy. It's actually about what the country looks like and what it will continue to look like. But I got to tell you, though, I think we're running out of time.
Yeah. It's also, and this is kind of a subtext in your whole book, it's also about what the power relationships are between people who are living and working next to each other in this country are.
Yeah. That's totally a subtext in the book. I wanted to be very intentional about underscoring the reality that this has been a marriage. It's almost like it's a conspiracy of something. Right. My first book event. It was kind of private. It was at the Aspen Ideas Festival this summer, and David Brooks interviewed me for the thing, and it was actually a very interesting conversation. He started crying in the middle of the interview, which was I'm looking at him, and David Brooks is like weeping, and I didn't know what to do. I was like, "Do you want a tissue?" I think that's what he said. But after the conversation, you know, I was signing early copies of the book. And this man came up to me and said, "Here's my business card. I employ 17,000 undocumented people." I looked him up. He's in Texas. I'm not going to say the city. And he employs 17,000 undocumented people. In a state of Texas where people like us, by the way, can't drive. There's only 12 states that allow us to drive. Thankfully, California is one of them. And I, you know, I've been kind of haunted by that. And I, of course, I gave him my number. I'm like, "Sir, when you're ready to tell your story publicly, I would love to help you do that and talk about how this happened and why this is happening." That's the thing. I mean, whenever we talk about, quote unquote, the criminality of undocumented workers, we don't ever seem to actually talk about the employers. I don't know why that is. Meaning, undocumented people living in this country for decades, people like me, we can't lie and pass and hide our way through the American system by ourselves, right? Like, we're not the only ones doing this, meaning other people are helping us out for the good, for the bad, for whatever reason. And I think we have to understand that. We have to understand that, you know, this has been, you know, in many ways intentional. Right. Like in the book, I make a point in saying that I don't think we have a broken immigration system, because when we say that, I'm like, "Hey, I broke my ankle. That was an accident. I tripped." This seems like, you know, deliberate. Right. That we are addicted to cheap labor and we need that. Right. We want a class of people that we can keep taxing them, because that's the other reality of this that we don't talk about. Undocumented people actually contribute billions of dollars to the economy. We don't have to talk about that. And yet, what's the narrative? You know, as you know, there's a chapter in the book literally called The Master Narrative. And the master narrative of immigration does not capture the reality of what this issue is and what it really means in the American consciousness.
The book is Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. The author with me in studio, Jose Antonio Vargas. There was a larger political critique of the push for the DREAM Act. Mm. And the narrative around it, that it was creating a good immigrant, bad immigrant dichotomy and leaving a lot of people behind the process.
That was in 2010. That was before I came out. And I didn't realize it until after the fact that my coming out was kind of married to that, meaning they thought that some people had thought that I had come out to help perpetuate this good immigrant.
Well, you were the archetypal good immigrant, right?
See, I don't know what that even means.
Well, brought here before you were 16, highly professionally successful and accomplished in a public service profession, like
completely
journalism.
Completely broken, absolutely depressed, don't know what to do with myself. That's what I want to talk about. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk about like what the resume looks like. I don't want to, because then I had to figure out that didn't matter. So that's why I push back, especially as someone who's Asian, because I think what happens is we get projected onto this model minority thing, mm-hmm. right? And which is so dangerous and creates a burden that I don't think we can hold. But yeah, and I had to keep reminding people, I went to San Francisco State University when it was $800. I was not like some straight A student, like meaning people were projecting onto me that I was this like good immigrant archetype. And all I could say was like, to whom? To you? Maybe, but to me, I'm a mess. I was a mess then and I'm a bigger mess now, right? So, and that's the thing. I am, even those archetypes, I don't know what purpose they serve. I don't.
What do you think about the consequences of that coming out? Has it made you safer or more precarious?
I think depends on who you ask. I think if you ask my lawyers, they're going to say more precarious. But for me, this book was something that I totally did not expect, was that the book gave me a greater sense of clarity. Like, I make so much more sense to myself now, mm-hmm. right? Like, I understand now why I am the way that I am, why I can't keep relationships, why I run from people, why I like living in hotel rooms. Like, now all of that makes sense. And now I got to go fix me. Mm-hmm. Now I got to figure out what home means for me and where I'm going to go find it. The only reason I'm in America is because I've found home in people, right? People who have known me for years and people that I don't have to defend myself to and explain myself to. Physical space, home. You know, I wrote the book. I think I say this in the book in the acknowledgments that I wrote the book in like Airbnbs and hotel rooms and like spare bedrooms of friends. And part of that too was kind of capturing that displacement and the fact that I'm always on the go. And that's part of even the writing of the book. So James Baldwin likes to say that, you know, all safety is an illusion. I heard him say that, you know, in all the YouTube videos that are up. I think, you know, more than a decade ago, and I was, you know, rolled my eyes, whatever. Now I'm like, oh man, he's totally right. All safety is an illusion. You know, I did not realize until I went through this process that all those years of hiding from the government actually led to me hiding from myself. I did not realize that when the government invalidates you and doesn't want to see you, then you start doing that to yourself. The severance of the self has direct consequences when it comes to the severance from the government. So again, like, I don't. Some people will say that I may be in a precarious situation, which I am legally, but I actually feel a lot more like myself now. And thankfully, because, you know, I'm 37. I'm like an adult. I was a dreamer before there was a Dream Act, you know, when we couldn't find each other because there was no way to do that.
Yeah. You opened the book by talking about your present legal status, that you have a set of papers, a warrant for arrest of alien that you're required by law to carry with you wherever you go in the country.
I do have it with me.
Really?
Yeah, I carry it with me.
And this is, first of all, your only legal federal documents from the government.
Outside of the IRS. Outside of the IRS
Fair
saying.
Fair enough.
Outside of the IRS saying, Mr. Vargas, this is how much you owe. And, you know, I'm happy to pay it. I'm a product of public schools. I love public libraries. I think it's important that we have paved roads and all that. So, yeah.
And this is also the opening move in a deportation proceeding that could resume motion at any point in time.
At any point in time.
In a way that's completely
it.
Out of your control.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's brutal.
No, it's... But that, you know, that's the thing too. Writing that down was actually like very clarifying. I just wrote it down. I mean, you know, the first sentence of the book is, I don't know where I'll be by the time you read this. I don't know where I'll be. Yeah. But I'd rather know that than not know that. You know what I mean? Like, I'd rather face that than pretend that it's not there.
So, like, what do your family think of the route you've taken? Go as public as possible, go as big as possible. What does your mom think?
Oh.
um,
the power dynamic is all off, right? Meaning I had been supporting my mother since I was in my mid-20s, right? Mm-hmm. I can only imagine how she feels in terms of what she thinks she can tell me or what she can tell me not to do or to do. That's the other thing that I realized too, in terms of my Filipino family and the dynamic is no one tells me what to do, which is kind of, I think I've been so independent for so long that I didn't even ask for their permission that I was going to do this, which is, you know, in and itself, I don't know how to even interpret that. I didn't ask for their permission. I just said that I have to do this now. This is what I'm going to do. Now, my grandmother, my Lola, who I love dearly, I cannot even imagine what kind of stress I have caused her. She lives in Mountain View in the house where I grew up. And I take her to Las Vegas a lot. She loves the slot machines. So I feel like the way I pay her back in the past 7 years is I take her and my grandfather's sisters to Vegas at least, you know, twice a year so they can like sit there and like do the slots and have fun.
Nobody said we're proud of you.
Oh gosh. My mom says that. She says she's proud of me. My Lola, a few months ago, something incredible happened, probably the most incredible thing that's happened to me. The local school district that I grew up in decided to name an elementary school after me, which is bananas. Mm-hmm. Right? You gotta love America. They won't give me a green card, but they're naming a public school after me in Mountain View. And that was the first time that I think my grandmother understood what this is. Right? Like that was the first time she actually called and just started crying and, you know, because she saw it in the newspaper, the same newspaper that I started working in when I was a kid and the same newspaper that my grandmother screamed out loud, "Why is your name in the paper?" Right? In the same newspaper, she read that the elementary school is going to be named after me and she got that. She understood what that was. And that was probably the proudest I've ever heard her, you know, that's probably the proudest I've ever heard her talk about anything I've done.
Yeah. Having your name in the local paper in Mountain View is a bigger deal than having it on a Pulitzer Prize.
She didn't know what that was. She couldn't care. You know, like the Washington Post, she didn't know what that was. But seeing that Jose Antonio Vargas Elementary School on Wiseman Road in Mountain View, like a few blocks from where she lives, that she can walk to it, like that was incredible to hear her. And that's why there's a part of me too that's like, again, that's totally unexpected. I never would have imagined 7 years ago when I started doing this that that would ever even happen. But then I thought about the fact that when I was first approached about that, the superintendent of the school, Allende Rudolph, tweeted at me. And I thought it was a joke. I said to him, I think I said something like, "I'm not dead yet. Is this a joke?" And then he said, no, there's a school board member, Tamara Wilson, and she's proposed it. And then I thought to myself, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Like somebody from Mountain View is going to say, no, we don't name a school after someone who's here illegally. And then the months went by and then the official vote happened and then no one complained. I mean, at least that I knew of. And to me, what it signaled was that they may disagree with me. They may not agree with whatever I say politically, but no one can dispute the fact that I'm from Mountain View. Like that's where I'm from. Right? And so this idea that every community has to decide who's welcome, every community has to decide how they define American and who's welcome, more than ever at a time like this when, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in D.C. I don't know if it's fixable. But I think what we do know, what our history tells us, is all politics is local. Mm. So local communities have to decide how they want their communities to be, how welcoming they want their communities to be, and who feels home in their communities.
You must have played through the scenario in your head of the federal government actually pulling off a deportation. Suddenly you find yourself in Manila for the first time since you were 12 years old.
I have run through, as a journalist, I've run through all the scenarios. It wouldn't take that quickly, meaning it's going to be a battle in the courts for a while. But no, absolutely, they can do that. I don't know, given President Duterte and how he doesn't like journalists. So I don't know if the Philippines is a place where I want to go, meaning if they deport me, I may want to try to go somewhere else and try to figure out how to get a visa in a place like, I don't know, Canada, maybe the UK. So I've run through all those scenarios in my head. Now, this is the reason why, too, that I haven't, to this day, for the past year and a half now, I don't have a permanent address. I don't have a place. I haven't decided yet if I'm going to get a place and where I'm going to be. So yeah, just my bags are packed. Like my bags are already packed. So, and everything I own is either in storage in Los Angeles where I used to live or my grandma's garage. So every piece of paper that matters, like yearbooks, diplomas, probably my greatest physical possession is my Mountain View High School diploma. That's in my grandma's garage. So I'm good. Like I'm prepared, you know?
You don't sound totally convinced when you say that.
Well, I mean, I am as prepared as I can be. That's the thing, though. I mean, man, I have to keep telling myself the influence of Toni Morrison when I read The Bluest Eye in eighth grade at Crittenden Middle School. Freedom is in my mind. Yeah. Freedom. Like, I am free enough that I could go write this in a country that doesn't even see me as one of its own. Uh-huh. Like, I'm free enough that I can actually put in writing on paper who I am and how I fit in this country. So that's the kind of freedom that no law and no president can take away from me.
Well, let me flip the hypothetical around. If the Kamala Harris Elizabeth Warren administration tomorrow says we're not enforcing any of this until Congress fixes it and Congress hops to and hands you your permanent resident card the next day. What would that mean? What would change? What would you do the first day you were fully documented in America?
What a great question. Here's the thing. I'm already an American. I'm just waiting for my own country to recognize it. So giving me a piece of paper, passing a law, I mean, I'd welcome that. That would be wonderful. But I'm not sure it would change anything in the way I think about kind of where I am.
Wouldn't make you get some of those things out of storage, unpack your bags?
Oh, I mean, I'd do that.
Sign a lease.
I would do that. That I would do. But meaning this whole feeling of being welcome and having a home, those are questions that I have to ask myself, right? Like, you know, as you know, in the book, there's a part in the book when I was in North Carolina and this elderly black woman approaches me. She saw me at PBS and she says, Mr. Vargas, I'm not an immigrant. You know, my ancestors were brought here as slaves. And she pulled out a piece of paper. She opened it up. It was a bill of sale. And then she says, can you connect the piece of paper that my great-great-grandmother got to the pieces of papers that you and your people can't seem to get? This is bigger than papers, Mr. Vargas. Think bigger. That was 2013. I have to tell you, that totally changed the way I thought of what was possible. Meaning, I think we pass immigration reform, we legalize people, we're done. I would argue that would just be the beginning, right? In the same way that, you know, the 14th Amendment guaranteed the equal protection of black people in this country. Pieces of laws only matter if society actually lives up to what they are. Right? If justice is the same as legality. And I think in the history of our country, we know that what's legal hasn't always been just. So keeping that in mind to me is very important. Or when a young man from Puerto Rico, right after the Hurricane Maria, reached out and said, hey, Jose, I know you're not a citizen, but I'm a citizen, man. And it's not all it's cracked up to be. We can't get electricity in San Juan. Mm-hmm. Right? And so that's why this conversation that I was hoping to kind of start with this book was, what constitutes citizenship? Like, how are we responsible for each other? How do we participate? You know, I can't talk about immigrant rights and not talk about all these other issues like the Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, the movement for LGBTQ rights, income equality, all of these issues are interconnected. And I think citizenship requires that we all stand up for each other and that we all try to see each other.
I'm curious, a lot of your work as a journalist has been trying to change switch which stories are on the periphery and which stories are on the center.
There's
an anecdote you used to tell where the Washington Post puts you on their new diversity beat,
oh,
which is supposed to be where we write about people of color as
actually,
objects of study.
Actually, it was the San Francisco Chronicle.
Oh, was it the Chronicle?
It was the Chronicle. Oh, my God. Okay, go ahead. Keep going. That was,
And then they were a little perturbed by an article you write about how Caucasians are wrestling with their identity.
I have to tell you, I think I've written like 800 news stories in my career, maybe 1,000 now. I'm probably most... Those are the top five for me, because the look on all the editors' eyes when I said, I want to write about white people. What? Because usually diversity beat means you cover people of color. And it was all people of color, Patti Poblete, Vanessa Waugh, Cicero Estrella. It was all people of color, like, you know, assigned to cover people of color. And this was the same time that I think it was Stanford University came up with a study that said that the Bay Area was the first minority-majority region in the country.
Right.
And there was a young woman in Oakley who started the Caucasian Club and caused like a furor. She was on CNN. Lisa McClellan, I think, was her name. And she was going to a high school that was predominantly white, but she felt the need to start a Caucasian Club. And so I told the city editor, Eric Matthews, I'm going to go write about Lisa. He was like, what? And then I wrote about that. And then I proposed an entire series on what it means to be white in a region that's getting less and less white. This was 2003. And the first big story, the lead, the first sentence in the story was, the other students call her white girl. Her name was Justine Steele. She was one of, I think, 8% of white students at Independence High School in San Jose, where there's like 4,000 students, 8% of whom are white. And they all played water polo and hung out in room D12. And I'll never forget just all the commotion around this story from the editors, all of whom were white, who thought that the story was a little bit problematic. And they didn't want that lead. The other students call her white girl. And, you know, back then, the Sunday paper still mattered a lot. You know, like being a Sunday front page was like the best thing to happen, right? And I remember one of the editors said, well, we can't put this in the Sunday paper if that's the lead. And I said, well, this doesn't have to be in the Sunday paper. You can run in a day. Because I really wanted that lead. Because mm-hmm. that's how Justine Steele was called. She was called white girl.
Yeah.
So to me, white identity cannot be divorced from what's happening, right? And especially considering that the first time this country considered who got to be a citizen was in the late 1790s. And it's when it said, when the country said that the only people who could be citizens were white people of good moral character. So unless you're Native American, unless you're an African American, you came here from somewhere, especially if you're white, I think you have to ask yourselves three fundamental questions. Where did you come from? How'd you get here? Who paid? If you can't answer those three questions, I kind of, you know, for me, the Philippines smuggled $4,500.
And you can't avoid those questions.
I can't avoid those questions. I think for a lot of white people, especially people who have, you know, great grandparents and 3, 4, 5 generations ago, it's too convenient to just, you know, live up this myth that, oh, my great grandparents did it the right way, which is what Bill O'Reilly likes to say, right? What right way? I'm sorry, was there a visa process after the potato famine in Ireland that I don't know about? Like, was there, what, how much was the green card worth? Was Border Patrol around? So this inquiry, I mean, the digging up of where we come from, to me, has to be a part of this conversation. I think it's inescapable.
The reaction from your editors is so telling. I mean, it's long been a real rite of passage for white journalists to go write about oppressed people of color somewhere.
Oh, yeah. And they win awards for it.
It's a chops if it's abroad.
It's a chops if it's abroad. And then they win Pulitzers for it.
Yeah.
Actually, I remember one of my colleagues at the Washington Post said, we're not, when people have, and this was, you know, a decade ago now, and things are changing a little bit, which is great. But like, people of color are not allowed to write about ourselves in our communities. It's called advocacy. Mm-hmm. When white people do it, it's called journalism, right? And I'm like, why? What does that mean?
And when you write about white people.
Then when you write about white people, that's when it gets really dangerous, because how dare you even question it? Mm-hmm. But for me, I mean, I say this in the book. I think in many ways what we're living through is the fact that white people not being able to carry the burden of the whiteness that has been constructed, right? You know, people of color, there's a lot of conversations around the fact that people of color can't keep kind of carrying white people and be like, okay, let me teach you how racism works and what white privilege is and entitlement and all that. To me, the question now, though, is what kind of work are white people, you know, willing to put into this, right? I make a point in the book that, you know, I am here because of the generosity of white people from Mountain View High School. But when I was growing up, I didn't think they were white because I associated whiteness with how people made you feel, like condescended to, less than. The people that, you know, supported me, they never made me feel like that. It wasn't until I moved to Washington, D.C. that I met real white people. That's when I met white people, right? But from Mountain View, I didn't. I don't know how that happened. I just was lucky that I was surrounded by people that I was not a problem to them. I was just someone they wanted to help.
That's going to be the moment I keep thinking on after this interview, what it means to think of whiteness that is something done to you rather than something that you are. Jose Antonio Vargas, thank you for everything in this book that made me think.
Oh, thank you so much for this conversation.
Jose Antonio Vargas is CEO of the nonprofit Define American. He is an extraordinarily accomplished journalist and documentary filmmaker. His new book, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen.